Here go the questions. The first, I am sure, is the one that preys on all of our minds, on our families, on everyone we know. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Boy, do we want to hear the answer to this one. Is there anyone on the planet who can beat the Yukon women? Would you like to answer that? Here comes the economist.
You know, we're trained to dodge particularly sensitive questions like this. But if you look in the bio, you may see my affiliation. So for fear that my alumni association would come down too hard on me, I'd say if there's any chance in the world that anyone can beat the UConn women, I'll go with Stanford.
All right, that'll be reported in the headlines of the Current first thing in the morning. Now, here's a question literally germane to everything that Dennis said. What effect will the Federal Reserve pullout from the mortgage market have on fixed income yields overall and on the housing market in particular?
The question of, by the way, today is the day in which the mortgage-backed securities program of $1.25 trillion of purchases essentially expires. I think the last purchase is actually a few days ago, but this is the last day. So it has been a matter of some debate for quite a number of months of what that effect would be. And there were times in which some people speculated that we could see 50 or more basis points increase in mortgage rates just from the Fed ceasing its program of purchases. I have been saying for quite some time, and I think it is bearing out, that the effect is likely to be relatively small, a few basis points conceivably. It appears to me that the private markets are poised to, in effect, fill the void of the Fed leaving the mortgage-backed securities market, or purchases of mortgage-backed securities. And consequently, I think the effect on rates and the effect on the housing sector should not be adverse. And the rates are, by any standard, they continue to be very attractive for home buyers. If they're a little above 5% or around 5% for the 30-year conventional mortgage, those are very attractive rates historically. So my view is that the ceasing of our purchases, the Fed's purchases, should have relatively light effect, and the rates in place should continue to help stabilize the housing sector.
Here's another. In the event the economic recovery in the country fails to gain traction, yet global forces put upward pressure on inflation and interest rates, what specific tools and or resources would the Fed employ to counter stagflation?
Well, stagflation, which some of us in the room are old enough to remember, is an exceptionally thorny kind of economic problem. And obviously what you have to do to deal with it is essentially focus on bringing down inflation, but do that in a way that is as benign as possible to the broad economy and employment. I don't think it's an easy calculation. In my mind, policymakers would simply have to balance the tools they have to generate growth, to get out of the stag part of stagflation, and at the same time discourage inflation to get out of the inflation part of stagflation. Let me talk a little bit then about what is a concern that some people hold, and that is that a lot of money has been printed in the last 2 years and resides in the monetary base on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. Typically, the Federal Reserve, prior to the recession, would have had something like $30 to $50 billion of excess bank reserves on its balance sheet. Today, that number is closer to $1.2 trillion. That's a very large piece of the Fed's liability structure, and it is essentially dormant today. It has not been translated by banks into lending. There are those who took Econ 1 or Econ 101, like most of us in the room did, and learned that that kind of money creation on the monetary base is potentially inflationary. I'm very confident that we're going to be able to drain those reserves and shrink the balance sheet at the appropriate time. I don't think the time is appropriate quite yet, but at the appropriate time. We've been working hard over the last few months on perfecting operationally and legally the tools that we will need to drain those reserves, and we've also been doing a great deal of planning for the eventuality that that draining must begin. So I'm really confident on that side. The best thing we can do for the growth of the economy for the time being is to remain relatively accommodative in our interest rate structure. You know, we're not the fiscal agent. We're the monetary agent. So it's essentially through interest rates that we most influence the economy. I am not looking for, however, a renewal of these large-scale asset purchase programs, the one that expired today and others. So that's a summary of kind of how we deal with that tension that is represented in stagflation.
A related one, as unemployment drops and the demand for money increases, what are the key metrics for all of us to watch to gauge the inflationary implications, and what will the Fed do?
Well, the key metrics one would watch would be essentially measures of lending in the economy, because the credit channel for the transmission of monetary stimulus is the key channel through which monetary policy is felt in the economy. So logically, what you'd look at is whether measures of bank lending are rising, and whether you know, perhaps some capital market issuance of debt, particularly debt, is rising. So you would watch for that. In order to determine whether that growth in credit has inflationary consequences or inflationary implications, I think you would clearly want to look at what our policy is to deal with any indication of rising inflation. I mentioned in the remarks both the term inflation and inflation expectations. I watch, let's say, inflation expectations very closely and carefully. It's a little bit of an elusive thing to track, because you look for indications in securities markets. For example, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities Market, TIPS market, and you also get some feedback from surveys, household and consumer surveys, of what they think inflation will be. But I watch very carefully how those expectations are moving. And with a rise in expectations, which I think of as simply the basis for a consumer or a business person beginning to act on that expectation of inflation, and therefore by acting conceivably build in some inflationary impetus in the economy, I watch carefully that, because that's the time to begin to act from the point of view of monetary policy.
And again, a related one, what is the Fed or the Treasury doing economically that may help lessen uncertainty as an influence on the capital markets?
Well, I'll speak only for the Fed on that question, and the Treasury can speak for itself. We communicate a lot, in a lot of different ways. And in our communication, as today, we try to spell out sort of what we think the outlook for the economy is, the outlook on which we're basing policy. Understand that any action that is taken takes some time to work its way through the economy. So outlook really is as important as current circumstances, more important than current circumstances. So we communicate a lot and try to communicate very clearly. Chairman Bernanke testifies a couple times a year on the state of monetary policy, and recently has been testifying on a number of other aspects of the economy. Particularly, he's testified recently on so-called exit programs or exit measures that we might take. And all of the people in my position as presidents of reserve banks are out there communicating as best we can to the general public about essentially what our views are of the future, as well as our rationale for the current policy, trying to interpret policy to the general public. In my part of the world in the Southeast, I and about six or seven other colleagues last year made over 400 speeches. And the principal message was about this: what's going on in the economy, what's the outlook, what should policymakers be thinking about, what are we doing? We think we touched some 30,000 people through those 400 speeches. So that's the principal thing we can do, is to be out there and communicate very candidly and apolitically. The central bank is an apolitical institution. That's, I guess, the most important thing we can do.
Since you touched in your very fine address those conditions that need to be in place for sustained growth, would you comment on this one? Given everything that's been done in the last several months, is it possible for the economy to dip back into negative growth in 2011?
One should never say never, I am not expecting a double dip. As it was clear from my remarks, I'm not expecting a double dip or a W-shaped path of the economy. I'm quite confident that we're going to see continued sustained recovery. Now, as I said, at a modest level of recovery, but I do not see us falling back into a recessionary set of conditions, short of some shock that comes out of the blue. And by nature, a shock would be something that we're not anticipating. We're watching a number of things for their potential. For example, I continue to watch the drama taking place in Europe with Greece, and I'm not totally discounting the potential of some kind of a sovereign debt contagion stress around the world. But at this time, I don't see really anything that would push us back into recessionary territory. So I'm basically discounting the call it W or the double dip.
Does the economy, given everything that you believe to be true today, need further stimulus in a greater government spending on economic infrastructure and or lower taxes? Basically, do you and your colleagues believe that the first stimulus was big enough?
Let me address the first stimulus, the $787 billion stimulus package first. It's probably a little too early to say. It has not all actually been expended, so it's not all out there. And the measures, what economists call the multiplier effect of the dollars spent on various categories of the economy, are yet to be measured in a way with great certainty. So it is still a little early to say. I would say that I think the stimulus package helped to extend employment and to some extent helped meet budget requirements of state and local government, particularly state governments, that bought them a little bit of time to deal with what is now pretty extraordinary pressures on the fiscal side at the state and local government level. So I think that was an effective part of the stimulus package. I'm not going to stand up here as a monetary policy official and endorse a fiscal action. I'll just simply wrap up the first part of the question in a statement that I think our current policy at the Federal Reserve, as I said, is appropriate. It's appropriate to keep in place for some time. It's accommodative. It's about, from an interest rate point of view, it's as accommodative as it can get. So obviously I'm a supporter of what we are now doing on the monetary side. And on the fiscal side, I certainly am very concerned about the fiscal pressures that the country's under and obviously would think long and hard about more stimulus, meaning a bigger deficit and more debt issuance. So that's about as far as I should go before I get in trouble. Thank you.
We have time for two more questions, I think. What, if any, impact do you believe the cost of the health care bill will have on the interest rates? We are seeing several companies take non-cash write-offs to their bottom line. Will this extend the slump in unemployment?
Unemployment. Well, first, I've seen no analysis of the effect of the recently passed health care bill on interest rates. So I'd have to sort of think on my feet about that question. You know, the way my mind works is that I wouldn't logically see a direct connection necessarily, except to the extent that over a period of time, you know, there are scenarios in which it adds to the deficit. There are scenarios, credible scenarios, in which it reduces the federal deficit. And as I said last week in Florida, I just don't know over the long term how this bill will actually play through. But a direct connection to interest rates, not something I necessarily see. But I haven't studied this carefully. As regards unemployment, again, let me be a little bit cautious about drawing a conclusion. Healthcare sector is a growth sector. You know, if you want to kind of come up with an example of the structural transition that we need to deal with and that we face with the skills mismatch issue that I brought up, it's taking a construction worker in Hartford and making him or her a nurse in Houston. That's the transition degree of difficulty. But the healthcare sector has been, along with education, a growth sector through the recession, virtually the only growth sectors through the recession. So I'm not sure I can make that connection either, quite frankly. But these are implications of the healthcare bill that we will have to study going forward. And so today I'd be a little bit cautious in trying to come up with any conclusions.
Last question, since we have 2.5 minutes by the Naval Observatory clock. If you get this one done in 2.5 minutes, we will nominate you for the Nobel Prize for Economy, for Economics. The financial regulatory reform is being debated in the 111th Congress right now. The House has already passed their bill. Now the Senate, led by Banking Committee Chair Chris Dodd, has their proposal on the table. Would you care to comment on what should be the best guide for policymakers around the following 2 or 3 points? Too big to fail in resolution authority, a consumer financial products authority, or the reform of credit rating agencies? 2.5 minutes. Go for it.
Calls for economy of language. You going to time me on this?
I am.
Well, let's talk about the too big to fail question. My view is that it's not solvable in a short period of time, that we're going to manage it over time as we manage down the problem. It's related to the systemic risk problem. My argument has been, and I stated this publicly as well in letters to senators in the 6th District, my part of the country, that we should think of, and this is the word guide, we should think of regulatory reform as improving the defenses of the country against another crisis. That we should not live in a world in which we delude ourselves that there will never be another financial crisis, or that current regulatory reform can essentially eliminate that risk. And therefore, the way we should think about what we do is that it is net improves our defenses against that next crisis. I think much that's out there now is going to be extremely helpful in that regard. We're going to have a systemic risk council that will be a group of regulators as well as the Treasury as the chair that are going to be focusing on risks that are more horizontal across the system as opposed to simply risks in specific institutions. One of the lessons of the financial crisis was that regulators were focused on individual institutions but didn't understand the interconnection across institutions. And when the situation in September of 2008 got to be extraordinarily dangerous, it was that contagion risk, that interconnectedness that really was, let's say, a void of adequate knowledge. And so we're going to be addressing that. The Dodd bill and the House bill both have what's called resolution authority, the ability for the regulators to move in and do something about a particularly risky institution, effectively wind it down or shrink it or sell it off, but resolve it, as that's a term of art among regulators. I think all of that will help us deal with the too big to fail and the systemic risk issue. Now, I'm overshot my time, I'm sure, but let me just make a couple comments on consumer financial protection. Currently, in the Dodd bill, it appears to me that there is a bureau that will be housed in the Federal Reserve but will be independent, and it will focus on consumer protection. I think we all agree that there needs to be a heightened attention to consumer protection. Consumer issues really triggered this financial crisis and the recession. At the same time, the Federal Reserve has done a great deal of work to try to strengthen regulations and to continue to examine banks on their compliance. And being relatively new to the Fed, I think that role is being well performed today. That's not to say that there weren't mistakes made prior to 2007. So I think we need to think carefully about whether a new agency is necessary.
I know I speak for all of us here in thanking you for coming to Hartford and especially for speaking clearly so that those of us who are not economists could follow everything you said.